Welcome to the Transcontinental Race Podcast, finding its way with Komoot, the home of those who go further. Komoot's the ultimate route planner and navigation app that helps you explore more. Put yourself in the mind of the transcontinental riders for a moment. You set off on your bike at 6 a.m. yesterday morning. It's late afternoon, and you've just crunched and ground your way up an 80-kilometer gravel climb. Some of the track was so rough that you got off and you picked up your bike. Your bike that's weighed down with everything you need for life on the road. Your cycling kit has waves of white salt marks all over it. You're feeling finished, but you're nearing the second control, nearing people who understand what you've been through. You find yourself at the top of a gravel mountain. You wave it good riddance as you drop your bike onto the tarmac and make the descent down to get your stamp at control point 2. You see the sponsorship flags blowing by the same wind that's now calling you as you roll down. The Physic logo has never made a place feel so homely. You roll up, and a Balkan wedding is in full swing.
And you expect to come to a wedding today?
My outfit is perfect for the wedding, so nothing can stop me.
Fiona Kolbinger, Cap 66, was the third ride of the day into the control. We'll join her by the canapes in a moment, but first, Anna Haslock and the Physic team at the control have just noticed something on the lead rider's bike.
Oh,
dear.
I dare not.
That's not a good sign.
That's not a good sign.
That's maybe why he's not looking too happy.
Bjorn Lennard had pulled into the hotel and immediately leaned his bike up and made his excuses to go to the bathroom. While he was down there, they noticed he'd added cushioning to his seat. He must have been suffering from saddle sores.
You don't want to see this.
No.
You don't want to know how it is.
The saddle sore? Is it because of the salt and the heat?
To be honest, I don't know really what the problem is. I'm going to see how it turns out. Going to carry on probably.
He made his way around the band carrying in their accordion, their horns and speakers, and we waved him off. But 45 minutes later, we heard footsteps coming up the stairs, and there was Bjorn carrying his bike, saying he was planning to stay in the hotel. He'd been stung by a wasp and his saddle sores were raw. If he was to have any hope of carrying on, he needed to spend some time looking after himself.
So a wasp just bite me in my ear. So I feel a bit dizzy as well, and well, of course my bum is. It's impossible to do it. Not for this distance. Part of the life, you know. So it started yesterday already. Okay. It was really in the evening. It was like up in the cold. It was pretty much okay, but I mean, the next 2 days gonna be 35 degrees, maybe 40. It doesn't make it any better. We'll have some fun here, we see. So that's good as well, you know. I have a shower and I'll be done.
See you.
3 hours later, Jonathan Rankin rode in, and Bjorn was sat by the volunteer's desk in a towel and his Oakleys with a beaming smile.
Hey!
Are you surprised to see Bjorn?
I had a first look at the tracker back there.
Okay.
As I came round to see where he was. Clicked on it, and the dot was right coming towards me.
Yeah, oh right.
But then it said an hour and 20 minutes ago, so I thought...
Johnny headed off into what has to have been one of the least restful restrooms anywhere in the world at that moment, and then he got back on the road. An hour after Johnny, German rider Cosmo Safraniak, Cap 159, crept past the wedding, got his stamp, and was off into the night. 15 minutes later, the wedding guests were spilling out onto the steps, smoking cigarettes and taking photos, when Fiona Kolbinger, Cap 66, pulled up at 20 past 6.
When I was on the parkour today, I had 3 punctures and crashed twice today. Once on the parkour when I couldn't clip out fast enough, and once at the border between Bulgaria and Serbia. There was another rider standing right next to the border barrier. And, wow, that's getting loud here. So there was another rider standing right next to the border barrier. He was on the toilet or something. I was waving, looking to the side. I didn't see the barrier, so I crashed right into it. I fell, so little skin on my elbows is off, but feels okay. So actually, the border barrier was bent, so it was a damage done to the Serbian people, I would say. So the border police confiscated my passport, and actually it took me like half an hour until I could continue. So I was always like, hey, I'm on a race. How long is it gonna take? And they were like, oh, we have never had this before. We need to call our boss to know what we are doing now. We don't know what's happening now because we've never had this before, anyone crashing into this barrier.
While all of the talk at the start of the ride had been about the gravel parkour on the way to CP2, from the moment the sun rose on the first day of the race, things started to sizzle out on the road.
This is Cap 85, Clayton Anderson, aka Little Kahuna, aka Papa Dandelion, aka Senior, I just want to pedal. We're out here, day one of the transcontinental race. Oh, and you can hear the roar in the background. Oh yeah. So, day one, it's hot, it's sticky, but the muscles, they ain't creaky yet.
That's Clayton Anderson, coming in strong with his opening message to the Transcontinental voicemail hotline. Just a few kilometers from the start, the riders hit the first gravel section of the race. As we drove further down the track, we went past the angular shapes of lycra-clad riders, doubled over, fixing punches and pumping up their tubes.
Start parkour is designed to split the riders up a bit, so we put in some gravel and sort of grass track.
Transcontinental race director Anna Haslock.
We're just at the end of that section now, watching them come in. It was designed to be a bit of a challenge, and I think it's been a bit of a challenge.
So you've had two punches today?
Three now. Yeah, not happy.
This is Matthew Falconer. Before each transcontinental, the riders are allocated a cycling cap with a number stamped on the underside of the peak. And Matthew is cap number two, because he came second last year. With that, he's carrying extra pressure. So three flats on day one is more than a little deflating. But when I spoke to him at the start line, he was trying not to let the idea of a win dominate his race.
It's actually quite a huge amount of pressure, but only as much as you make it, right? And so I was kind of, at the start of the year, I was quite keen to sort of like, you know, maybe have a go at that. But training never came to where I wanted it to. And I had to kind of reassess and just focus on enjoying it. I mean, that's the main thing. That's why I do it. So I've got a bit of base, you know, it's not like I'm completely unfit or anything, but yeah, there's a lot of extra fit guys out there, so we'll see. It's going to be interesting to watch, either in the thick of it or just from behind, so I'm looking forward to that.
Three punctures and nearly 12 hours of pedalling in overbearing sunshine, he arrived at control point one after the climb up the parkour.
I'm giving a card to this lady.
Oh dear, that was hard work.
People have been saying it's been quite hard to get a rhythm on that climb because the gradient keeps changing.
Yeah, and it's like 34 degrees and my legs cramping up and my bike's making all sorts of noises. It's all the good stuff. Mm. I was following three other people who were stopping and having to get their legs straightened out as well. So it's affecting everyone. It's the heat. Yeah.
Well, it's kind of reassuring. It doesn't make it any nicer, but no. At least you know it will hopefully go as the sun sets.
Yeah.
That afternoon, nearly everyone was battling with the heat on the parkour.
Oh, man, it's roasting.
So you're third?
I'm not. I'm third?
Yeah.
You having a laugh?
No.
Who's first and second?
Bjorn
and John?
Bjorn and Jonathan.
No way. Am I really third? That's why I feel so shattered. 18. Oh, thank you. Right, well, if I'm third, I better get going.
Get cracking.
Yeah. Jesus. Where did everyone go? There were loads of people in front of me.
I must have stopped when you didn't.
Yeah. How's it been today?
It's hard, especially down at this main road 6. The sun is relentless.
Like Chris Thomas in Cap 18 before her, it hadn't been obvious to Fiona Kolbener where she was in the race when she arrived at the control.
The roads are okay. I expected the roads to be worse. I expected the start parkour to have less gravel, though. So I was a bit surprised. I expected bad roads, but I didn't expect the gravel section. The good thing about the roads is that there are water fountains everywhere, so you don't need to stop very long. I already drank some 8 or 9 litres today. So, yeah. That's the most important thing, I think.
Do you guys know what number you are in the race?
I don't know.
Fifth, sixth.
I'm sixth overall.
Yeah.
What?
I think you came on first, so I think you're fifth, he's sixth.
Where did all the others go? No, I mean the others that have been in front of me from the beginning on.
They're at the water fountain.
All right. I'm surprised.
She was there just after Cap 240, Job Hendricks, arrived, and David Schuster, 112, rolled in just after her. As more riders came to get their stamps, the talk was all about the baking sun and the food they were planning to eat next.
How are you?
Oh, a bit broken. Kind of. Was doing just a nice little TT along the flat, and then just, yeah, decided to not be able to climb anymore. It was a complete... I think I just forgot how to, which was, yeah, a bit sad, really. Just watching everyone go past, being like, oh, that was a good 30 places higher when I started the climb. But that's all right. It's that's part of it. Got somewhere to know where I'm staying, which is, that's cheered me right up. And my friends have made a playlist for me, so halfway up, thank you very much. I was suddenly listening to S Club 7, followed by Stacey's Mum, which was absolutely iconic. Had a little dance to myself and then realised there was someone behind me who was watching, but that's alright. Yeah, I think everyone thinks I've gone mad. No, I think I've gone mad already. We're only on day one. It's a bit of time yet though. Can only get better, maybe. Just like it was 30 odd degrees just in the sun, but then there's no shade and it was reflecting off the road, and the road was heating up, so there wasn't really any escape for 3 hours.
Did you feel like you were cooking, or you're not burnt?
Yeah. No, not burnt, which is good, just cooking. I've lost count at 16 bottles of water, so it's sure it'd be all right. Try and find a big bowl of pasta in Caprera.
That climb was tough. I was only like 8 and off before the start, so it was pretty tough.
Did you just pick this up from one of those stalls over there?
This? Mm. No, I bought this in Lidl in Burgas. They're reasonable, 1,500 calories in a cake, so can't complain.
It's great just to see a cyclist pulling out an entire cake. And,
yeah. Not quite often. Or quite often. I'm sure that'll come out well on the podcast.
Nicole Clerks arrived with a saddlebag stuffed with packets of 7-day croissants, a kind of long life croissant that's become something of a rite of passage for TCR riders to live off. Photographer James Robertson was, as ever, on the scene with his camera and some mockery.
How many packets? It's an awful lot of 7-day croissants quite early on.
Yeah.
How's it been? Right.
This climb was a bitch, but apart from that, it was fun. It's amazing.
You guys are flying.
Oh, I loved the first parkour. It was amazing. The start, I just loved it. It was really fun. But how are you?
Tired and hungry.
I can imagine. Well, yeah. Same for me. But do you want a croissant?
Very bloody and sympathetic.
How's your ride going?
Good. Got a little bit pukey on my way up here, which was really pleasant. But I'm just making a conscious choice that I'm not going to puke, and so it's going to be fine.
This is Jenny Tuff. She's an endurance adventurer. She travels the world doing things like running 861 kilometres across the Atlas Mountains unsupported, and bikepacking the Silk Road Mountain Race through the high altitudes and rocky peaks of Kyrgyzstan. She's also ridden the Transatlantic Way, and started the Transcontinental 2 years ago, but had to scratch. I caught up with her at the start line and asked how she was feeling about this year.
I've done a couple of these races, but to be fair, I'm not really a cyclist. I'm actually more of a runner and just tend to have enthusiasm for long distance ultra events. Usually solo, not usually in a group of people, so this is a little bit out of my comfort zone. No, a little bit. It's way out of my comfort zone, actually.
What is it about there being lots of other people that puts it out of your comfort zone?
I guess it's the race aspect, the pace. And to be fair, it's out of my comfort zone in a really good way. It's really nice having people around. You learn a lot from the other riders, and that's a really cool thing. I think I'm used to being just alone in the mountains, just completely in my own head. And getting into the zone in that way, and with people around you, that just completely changes what you're doing and the mindset that you're in. So it's not a bad thing, it is just different for me.
Do you think there's advantages with that?
Maybe. I mean, I have to hope that there's going to be an advantage. I think there's a lot to be said for what it means to me, that I do have other things that, you know, if the bike doesn't go well, I'll always be able to go back to running and vice versa. I think I learn a lot from running that I can apply. So especially with the fast and light approach with running, I do long distance runs with just a backpack, with all the stuff that you would need for the TCR, obviously minus the bike tools, all that in a backpack. And the weight means a lot more when it's going straight into your body that way. So you learn a lot of different tricks and coping strategies and all sorts of things. But physically, I don't know. I think it probably pays to be a cyclist.
But for somebody that says you're not much of a cyclist, you did ride the TCR once before, and you've ridden Silk Road Mountain Race. You've done some long, long rides in your life. Let's talk about the last TCR. How did that go?
Oh, it was an absolute catastrophe. So I got about halfway through, and that was when we had the inferno through Italy. And I can look back at it objectively and know that I was really quite ill, and I was too ill for it to be safe to go. And of course, that was the year that we lost Frank, so we were all really on edge. And I just didn't feel comfortable in the condition that I was in, and even if I hadn't gotten sick, I still would have had other problems. So it's taken me a long time to kind of digest that and look back on that. It's the first and so far only challenge that I've walked away from, and that's what means the most to me coming back here, is that, you know, I've got a real score to settle, and that also means the stakes are really high for me. If this one doesn't work out, I don't know if I'll recover from that disappointment.
So what are the things that went wrong last time and the mistakes that were made that you've been working on for this ride?
I think massively I just wasn't super organized. I was quite faffy, maybe, if I look back on it. Kit wasn't super dialed in. Again, not being a cyclist, you know, that was 2 years ago of me not being a cyclist. So now I'm at least have 2 years more experience back then. I mean, what I learned on the Silk Road and the Transatlantic Way last year was that it really helped me to just get on a normal sleep schedule and not just kind of mess around and sleep when you want to, but actually be quite disciplined about it. So I had a real routine of getting in at midnight and then waking up at 4 and just keeping it to that. And your body, especially over a race as long as the TCR or the Silk Road, that really does help to get your body just on a normal rhythm.
I have read that you have developed some strategies that you use when you're doing sort of endurance events. Could you tell me a little bit about some of the things that you do to help in terms of coping mechanisms?
Yeah, so I mean, if things are going wrong inside your head, you've got to figure out what's the best way to pull yourself out. And that just really has come from experience. You know, sometimes it is just distraction time. Put on a podcast or a mojo playlist or something and just distract yourself from the pain. Other times you need to have a little heart-to-heart with yourself. I've got that Be More Mike sticker on my dashboard, and I've had a lot of conversations with those stickers over the years. And just talking to yourself about, you know, why you did this and why it's important and why you're so privileged to get to do this. I mean, that's something we should never forget, that, you know, this is hard, but it's intentionally hard. It's not suffering, it's a privilege that we have. So reminding myself of that, and yeah, trying to fix my mood in whichever way is going to work. A lot of the time it's just cheesy pop music, to be honest. I'll never disclose my playlist.
Her coping strategies were doing her proud at CP1, because after telling me that she'd been sick on the way up, she then started rapturing about the enormous concrete spaceship-like monument at the top of the parkour. Well, sort of.
I remember seeing it from the bottom going, that's so cool, it's so beautiful, but way up in the sky, and I'm down here. I don't want to go up there. Can't I just look at it from here? Ah, but it was so beautiful. Good punch in the face start.
The Buzluja monument certainly had the riders curious. Richard Morton is a PhD researcher at the University of Central Lancashire, who's been piecing together the history of the building and is a co-founder of the Buzluja project, which works to imagine what the future of the monument could be.
The first time I saw Buzluja was completely by accident, really. I saw this thing on the horizon, shaped like a giant concrete flying saucer, And I asked the Bulgarians I was with, you know, what on earth is that thing up there in the mountain? The first time I went, there was no security, there were no bars on the doors. You just had these great big front doors that were wide open. And we walked in, this would have been in spring, so this was late March, I think. But it was still, there was still snow around, there was still thick ice inside. And it was extraordinary. There was very little graffiti back then. And it really felt like something from another world. Back then, people would just arrive and walk straight in. And then at some point they decided to bar the front doors. And for several years after that, there were various different ways of getting in. So for a while there was a broken window on one side and people piled rocks beneath so you can kind of climb up and get in through the window. That was the main point of entry for about 18 months maybe. And then the government came and they blocked that off, and so it remained closed for a while. At one point somebody used a sledgehammer to break down through the concrete and then lower a rope into the basement and get into the monument that way. Things have changed a little since then. The internet has found it. So it's become very popular online, and unfortunately that's brought a lot of unwanted attention too. So there's a lot more graffiti now, a lot of vandalism at the site. And beginning in the summer of 2017, the government actually began forcibly keeping people out. So they began putting bars over all the entrances. That worked for a while, and then people would come and break the bars, and then they'd be fixed again. They'd stay fixed for maybe 2 or 3 months, and then somebody would come up in the night with a car and a tow hook and pull the bars off again. And it got to the point where the Bulgarian government ended up posting a 24/7 guard duty at the site. So that's the current state at the moment, that no one can go inside. The architect of the monument, Georgi Stoilov, said that he very much intended for the monument to look otherworldly. He told me, in Rome they have this building called the Colosseum, which is 40 meters across. So I decided to make one that was 60 meters across and put it inside a flying saucer. The idea behind it was that it was trying to present Bulgaria as this ancient civilization that was ready for the future, combining ancient architecture with kind of new atomic era themes of space travel and all the rest. The design brief was that they wanted a big red star on top of the mountain in some form or another.
The red star was placed at the top of a huge tower, and then the flying saucer-like building gave it the amphitheatre design that drew on Rome's Colosseum. But it was only open for less than a decade, and then, with the fall of socialism, the shrine to its ideology fell out of favour, and the building was ransacked of valuable materials and abandoned.
It opened in 1981, and Bulgarian communism came to an end at the end of 1989. The first thing to go was this heavy copper roof, which was worth a fortune, and that disappeared overnight, after which the monument was just left unguarded, and the general decay began. By the mid-1990s, you have this situation where there's this huge, very expensive monument sat on top of a mountain full of expensive metals and marble and stones and so on. And people began to want to cash out, in a sense, to take their investment back. There was a popular rumour that circulated saying that the red stars in the tower, people said that they were actually made of rubies. The truth is it was a kind of synthetic ruby, so it was artificial glass. But believing that these were actual real rubies, some people went up there with their rifles and began taking shots at the stars to try and break out the rubies, thinking they'd have precious stones rain down on them. So a lot of the early damage to the monument was actually done by people who were trying to take back money which they felt had been taken from them.
The next morning we found riders lying in bivy bags below 2 huge stone fists and a torch that are carved into the mountainside below the monument. It was bearing down on them from above.
Morning.
Morning.
You don't know, it's whispered all night.
Did you sleep here?
Well, I was here, in the bag, yeah. Not sure I slept that much.
From the Bezluja monument, the riders then rode past another one, built in the same year on the Beklemento Pass. From there, they headed towards the Bulgarian capital, Sofia, and crossed the border into Serbia. Then it was the 80-kilometre gravel parkour that would take them to the control point too, near the town of Vranja and the Balkan wedding. Ben Davis was the fifth rider in.
How are you getting on?
I'm just finding it quite surreal.
I'm sat in the middle of a Balkan wedding whilst welcoming riders.
Is that
in.
What's happening in there?
Yeah.
That's funny.
How's today been?
Yeah, it was good. It took a lot longer than I expected, so I just I hadn't realised how gravelly it was.
Do you think if you'd have known that you would have had a bit more rest beforehand?
No, I would have wore different shoes though.
You're wearing road cleats rather than SPDs.
Yeah. And the second hill was like, I couldn't climb it. Could Bjorn get up it? I don't know.
I would wonder if anyone came away this time. To be honest, were they going to do this?
On both of the climbs, really, it was really slow. It was pretty hot. So I've got heat rash and stuff, but I think it's right.
Just a bit of heat rash, you'll shake that off, man. Love how you say it so calmly.
I just got absolutely battered up there. My ass kills, and my hands kill. I've been breaking the whole way down.
After Ben arrived, we started to hear thunderclaps getting closer. We could see rain over the parkour and forked lightning. At 8:45, David Schuster turned up.
I'm David, Cap 112, from Paris. It's nice to be there.
Did you beat the rain here, or did you get wet?
I get wet, but no, not too much rain. I just get wet during the downhill. I have two flats.
You had two flats on the way down.
Yeah, that's why I take so long to come. I was expecting to come when it will be daylight, but now it's just night, so it's okay. I have to take that, so it will be okay.
That's hard, but nicer that you got the flats on the way up when it wasn't raining, and then you could at least come down in the rain. And cool off, I suppose.
Yeah, it was beautiful to see that. Yeah, and I was at the top, and it was always daylight, so it was really beautiful. A view on all the mountains, so really good, but a lot of wind. I have to take my bike and to get it very well because it was going with the wind.
Oh, okay, so it was so windy that it was blowing you over.
That's it.
Wow,
that's it. Just at the top, it was really, really windy. So I know that some people were going up when I was going down, and for them it will be really difficult because it will be the night, the wind, they won't see anything, and you can't go on the bike, you have to just walk. It's in the stones, big stones, so it will be like 2 kilometers of walking. So it's quite difficult to go up.
And what are you doing now? It's wet out there, so are you going to bivvy or are you going to look for a hotel?
I don't want to look for too many times, so I think I will just find somewhere I can put my bivvy and sleep. I would like to go for maybe 50 or 60 more kilometers, but it looks like it's a storm coming for the next 2 hours, so I think it's better for me to sleep and go after the storm.
Chris Thomas, Cap 18, arrived 45 minutes later. He got the worst of the weather and the worst of luck.
Just come down in the rain and get two punctures.
Double puncture in one hit on the descent. Not one puncture on any of the gravel all the way, basically out of the saddle for about 50 kilometres. My hamstrings, my hips, my knees, my hands, everything hurts. Absolutely everything hurts. But then, I've got like a metaphor for this. You know when a spider gets vacked up and it goes into the bag and it must think to itself, oh my God, there's no way out of this. It's never ending, I'm dead. But as soon as that vacuum goes off, that spider, if it works hard enough, can make its way back out of the vacuum cleaner. That's what that felt like. I felt like the spider. I was like, this will never, ever end. This is just going to go on for the rest of my life.
Mate, I can't believe that you've also had that and now you've walked into a wedding.
I know.
At that point, we started to watch the GPS tracker so that we could see how riders were getting on in the storm. Most had buckled down for the night and we went home for the evening. When we woke in the morning, Bjorn had some news for us about his plans. How are you?
Well, feeling pretty well actually. I mean, had a good sleep, had some good breakfast, enjoying the sun.
But the saddle sores, any sign, any hope that you're going to be able to get back on the bike, do you think?
It's impossible to keep riding, really. Yesterday evening I looked again on it and there was still an abscess from about 1 centimeter. This doesn't heal in another day or two, so no chance to keep riding.
It's such a shame.
So you're going to have to scratch?
That's the plan, yeah. I mean...
So, Fiona is in the lead. You know Fiona.
Well, Fiona is from the same hometown than me. So, we did a lot of preparation in front of it. I mean, like, building up her bike and do some riding together and everything, so...
So it must be a bit bittersweet, but at least you must be happy that if anyone's going to be out front, that at the moment it's her.
Well, my cap is still leading, you know. No, it's my heart is with her, to be honest. That she is doing so well on that. It's I'm just checking every minute now the tracker and everything, how she's going on and everything. It's really cool how she do it.
You take these things incredibly well, but it must be so frustrating for you.
Yeah, it's for sure a bit frustrating if I see all the riders keep going here and I have to stay here. But as I said, it's nothing I can change. I have to live with it.
You've obviously been looking at what's happening in the race overnight, and you've been here overnight. So what was it like being here yesterday with the riders arriving and into this morning?
Well, it's actually pretty nice to see it from the other side, from the other perspective, like the volunteers, you know. Greeting the riders, have some hugs, and I mean, I know quite many of them, you know, so of course they all ask what the hell I'm doing here, but on the other hand, it's nice to see him and shake hands and enjoy it.
Well, thanks, Bjorn. I'm sorry that the race looks like it's going to have to end this way, but we'll see you at the finishers party.
For sure you see me there. I'm going to make my way there.
And hopefully it will heal in time for PBP.
Yeah, I hope until that everything is back together.
Thanks for listening to the Transcontinental Podcast, presented and produced by me, Tom Bonnet, and sponsored by Komoot. Subscribe to the podcast to make sure that you catch the next episode, where I'll be telling more stories from Control Point 2 and following the riders on their 1,000-kilometre journey over to CP3. Until then, you can keep up with all the action in our daily race reports and across the Transcontinental social media.
What's up, TCR hooligans? It's your boy, Cap85, Clayton, a.k.a. Fuzzy Salamander, a.k.a. Lunar Pilot, a.k.a. Furry Nectarine. Just wanted to give a little update, in case you were wondering. Just passed through Shipka, in case you didn't know. That is not a new cruise line on Royal Caribbean. So if you go there, start asking for a strawberry daiquiri, you're gonna get a lot of weird looks. So, just a forewarning, strawberry daiquiri's not a good idea.